entertained? Are you not entertained?
Quiet, numbskulls, I'm broadcasting.
You're listening to the French Press Podcast, where we discuss events from our lives. Welcome to the French Press Podcast. This is episode 194.
And it's Tuesday, August 1st, 2017.
Joining us today on the podcast is Courtney Hostetler. Courtney, it's good to have you here.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Courtney, you probably know because we had him on a few months ago, went on a long journey on the Appalachian Trail. He has a blog, Mountain Man Who Scripts. And it wasn't a daily blog, but it was pretty frequent, every few days, so you can go check that out. And Courtney is now done with his over 1,000-mile hike.
Right? Yeah, over 2,000 miles. Almost 2,200 miles.
Hold it. Wow. So we're going to talk about that. Jeffy is here, of course, as well. And Jeffy, I understand you have some feedback.
Yeah, what's your feedback, Jeff?
I do. As Layton shoves the mic into my nose. Mitch from work commented that he is disappointed, as one of the few who actually do vote on the polls, that there hasn't been a poll in the recent episodes. And he's just wondering what's up.
That's almost like he's requesting something. It's almost like a suggestion.
I know we didn't discuss this before the podcast, so I'm about to spring it upon both Jeff and Ruben. Mitch also suggested that, like, an actual poll question. So he suggested a poll that we could have.
Oh, okay, good.
Which is the first time that we've ever like had a poll submission.
Yeah, I think it is.
Yeah, like a first time that we could actually vote on something. His suggestion is to vote. Our fans could vote whether or not Jeff and Ruben should sign up for eHarmony.com.
Yeah, I mean, we could think about it.
Okay.
We've got a lot of other stuff to get to.
Yeah.
So we'll come back to that at the end of the episode.
All right.
Let's start. Courtney, Mountain Man Who Scripts, you're back, or you're finished now.
Yes. Highlander.
The Highlander.
Yes.
I know you told us, or we mentioned that Highlander was your name before.
Yeah.
But what does Highlander mean?
Well, the reason I chose that name, like, before I went on the trail. A lot of people get their trail name from some event that occurs to them or something that they do after they've already started hiking. But, so the reason I chose the name Highlander was because that was the name of the group that I chiefed at Bald Eagle Boys Camp for 2 years, 14 through 16. So, yeah, it was a really important part of my life. I feel so, like, hiking the trail has been a dream of mine for years, probably 5, 6, 7 years. But I feel like my time at camp and my involvement with the Highlander group and the trips we took and just problem solving and different things like that is really what gave me the courage that, you know what, I can do this and have that mental toughness to go out and get her done. So, yeah, it's very, yeah. I don't know, it's kind of a, it wouldn't mean a whole lot to other people, but for me, I knew what it stood for.
Yeah, it already kind of had... It was really kind of part of you.
Yeah.
It wasn't just exactly. You were thinking of a name and, oh, that's Highlander randomly is the name.
Yeah.
All right. That makes sense. You were out there for how much time was it when you first started? Or how long has it been in time?
So from when I started on the approach trail, April 9th, to July 22nd, those were the beginning and ending dates. And I think that was about 104 days, so like 3.5 months, pretty much.
Wow. And during that time, you met a bunch of people just from reading the blog. Sometimes you were with people for a couple of days. Sometimes you just met them once and never met them again.
Yeah.
I know you went out there, obviously, for some reason or purpose.
Mm-hmm.
What did most of the people that you asked, why were they out on the trails?
Mm-hmm. It's kind of interesting. I felt like there were two, like, kind of main groups of people. I mean, obviously it varied a lot, but felt like there were quite a few younger people, like, who were maybe just coming out of school or maybe, like, little upper 20s getting ready to do a career change or something like that. There were a lot of those type of people out there who kind of wanted to get away from their home and kind of use it as a transition period. Or maybe it's like, well, they don't have a job anyway, so use this as kind of a vacation time. Basically a time to kind of get away, get into nature, and, you know, challenge themselves, have a good time. That was a pretty big reason. Then there were also quite a few older people, like maybe mid-50s to like mid-60s, quite a few of those. And often that was just as kind of a, you know, they're retired, this has been a dream of theirs, or they've heard about it recently. And, you know, compared to other vacations, if you think of it as a vacation, it's definitely not very relaxing. But, or I mean, sometimes are. But compared to other vacations, you know, spending $4,000 to be gone for 5 or 6 months, it's not that expensive, you know. So it's a way for them to get out, do something they love, and do something active while they're retired.
Did you meet anyone on the trail where this was the first time that they really have been outdoors, either camping and were totally green?
I mean, okay, so I didn't meet them when they were green, but I heard people tell stories. Like one guy who actually I was hiking with at the end, his name was Chiclet, like the gum, actually. Funny story. So we were at the top of a, climbed this mountain, me and my hiking partner at that time, Cricket. He was from Manchester, England. So we climbed to the top, and this lady who was kind of a caretaker of this hut up there was telling us about this guy who had came in really late last night, kid, 19 years old, and his name was Chiclet. And I was like, Chiclet? Like the gum? And then she was like, no, like a baby chick. And I was, me and Cricket just looked at each other and like, a baby chick? Is that like an egg? Or like, what's a baby chick? So I don't know.
There you go.
Whatever.
But you met up with him then.
Larval version of a chicken. Yeah, so we met up with him, and he hiked with us for a few days. And he said before he, like, he only heard about the AT within, like, the last, like, 3 months or 4 months before he started hiking. He had never set up a tent except one time in his garden or his mom's garden, and he didn't even sleep in it. He just set it up to look at it.
Brilliant.
And his pack, even at this point, it was unbelievable. It was like 40 or 50 something pounds. So we cook with like little stoves that are attached to these fuel canisters, and he had had a fuel canister that was about half full. But then he came upon this sweet deal for a 16-ounce fuel canister, which is huge. Normally, you only carry like a 4 or 6 ounce one, for a 16-ounce, but it was a sweet deal. So he bought it, and he'd been carrying it with him for like the last 800 miles, this over a pound of fuel that was doing nothing for him. So anyway, kudos to him for having made it that
but
far.
But he never ran out.
Never ran out of fuel, but he did run out of steam eventually because
he ran out of human fuel.
Yeah, exactly. I felt bad for the guy though, because he was hiking with us. We were doing pretty high mile days. He was determined to keep up with us. And then the one evening, he had taped a blister on his toe. This was some pretty powerful tape called Leukotape. Anyway, he hadn't popped the blister. So I think what happened was the tape grabbed a hold of the blister skin. It was like pulling it around. That evening when he took the tape off, like the whole skin of his toe was like shifted sideways, like the nail was like shifted sideways, kind of like almost like slid off. And you could see this white, I'm pretty sure it was the bone, you could like see because it had just pulled it away. So we helped him limp a mile to a hostel, and then he left. He got off the trail. It was pretty sad. Thankfully, I contacted him after I was done. He said he was able to get on like a little while later, and he'd be finishing probably within a week or two from now.
Oh,
so,
cool.
Okay.
So that was definitely pretty cool. But yeah, crazy. So yeah, you meet all kinds of inexperienced people. People who start with 5 pounds of rice as their food. We met this other guy who was gonna, his only food on the trail was gonna be trail mix. He had bought 125 pounds of trail mix.
Trail mix isn't actually good.
It's not meant for the trail, is it?
Like, it's not actually like, hey, you know what? We're gonna pack all the nutrition that a person could possibly need while hiking a trail.
Yeah.
Like, it was not made with that in mind, was it?
No, no, it's not a complete nutrition. I mean, it's good. You know, he's got peanuts, especially if it's GORP, which is peanuts, raisins, and M&Ms. You got your sugar and some fat with the chocolate, and then some more fat and good protein and stuff with the peanuts and fiber with the peanuts and M&Ms. So it's, you know, it's fairly nutrient rich, but like vitamins and things like that, and you just get tired of it. I mean, like, seriously, you get pretty tired.
Do you think it would be possible for someone to do the entire AT only eating trail mix?
Well, possibly, but a Frenchman who was there when we were talking about this guy asked a very pertinent question, and that question was, did he also buy 125 rolls of toilet paper? And, you know, that would be pretty essential if you're going to be eating that much trail mix, because your diet, it just fundamentally shapes your bodily functions.
I see.
It's very interesting. So anyway, yeah, not to be graphic with it, but it would not be cool to only eat trail mix.
Okay.
So what was your reason then for going on this journey?
So I posted about that in my blog, and I'm just going to pull that up here. These were reasons that I had thought about, and they say you should have really, you know, reasons that will carry you through the hard times. And so I tried to think about it and look inside to see why am I doing this, you know? So I'm just going to read off 5 different reasons that I had here. And I'll make a comment on a few of them then that were probably more important than the others. But one was to challenge myself. Just, can I do this? Do I have the stamina, mental stamina? Because it's a lot more of a mental challenge than it is physical. I mean, it's hard physically, but you can do, like, 12 miles a day pretty easily. Like, it's not that hard. But can you do it after you've been walking in rain for 5 days straight and you're stinky and your feet, everything hurts, you know? So to challenge myself, to process the last few years of my life, as well as think about where God is leading me in the future, and just, you know, coming out of camp this last Christmas, feel like that was definitely a, you know, challenging time in my life where God used the events and the people there to stretch me. So to think about that, and also think about where He's leading me in the future. It's been a dream of mine, and so I don't want to look back years from now and say I wish I would have. I don't want to have that regret. There's a quote from Henry David Thoreau that was stuck out to me, and that said, I went to the woods because I wished to live deliberately, to front only the essential facts of life, and see if I could not learn what it had to teach, and not, when I came to die, discover that I had not lived. And so I don't want to look back and be like, man, I could have done it, but I didn't. And another one was to set an example that will hopefully inspire others to set goals, to dream, to go out and do it. Because, you know, anyone could do this. And the last reason is just because I can. I mean, this is a time in my life, it worked out, so let's go do it. And definitely the just thinking about my life, you know, trying to connect with God and setting an example to others. I think those were the two main ones that really carried me through. You know, there were definitely times when I wanted to quit, but it was during those times that I remember one time very specifically. It was in the Shenandoahs. We weren't getting in the miles that we wanted to. I was stressed about it. It was raining. And I was just like, I was feeling discouraged. And I was like, man, you know, the halfway point is coming up. Maybe I'll just do the other half some other time. And then I was like, no, you set out to do the whole thing. And so I prayed about it. I'm like, God, I'm just really feeling down right now. And this is just really hard. And it's getting dark. We need to find a campsite. Anyway. And within like, in 5 minutes, not even 5 minutes, like just after that, I just felt like it was the craziest thing. I just felt like this heaviness lifting off of me, and I felt more cheerful, and I started humming, and it was just like, I felt good. Mm-hmm. And it was just very real, just I really felt God with me during that time. Mm-hmm. And I think that was one of the biggest things that changed for me throughout this trip, is that I in a new way, feel like I learned how personal God is and how involved he is in the small daily things in our life, how much he cares about the small details. It is, yeah, so beautiful. It's awesome.
We do want to get to what are you going to do after, sure, after this, because you're, sure, back now. You've had time to think, and mm-hmm, you mentioned that was one of the reasons that you went, yeah, was to kind of map out or think about what lies ahead of you. But absolutely, I do want to talk about some specific things on the trail.
Sure.
And one of the posts from the last month, I think it was sometime in July, you mentioned that you were going up a mountain, and I forget the exact details, but something to the effect of, it was almost life-threatening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that, dude, I tell you what, southern Maine is brutal. Like, it's not the longest climbs, but Maine is, I mean, pretty much, it's just a giant rock with a small covering of a few inches of dirt. I mean, it's what it seems like. Just granite. And so a couple of climbs, one of them was Mahusik Arm is what it was called. It was just like, I don't know if it's quite, probably around 45 degrees, maybe more actually, of not dirt that you can grip, but just literally smooth rock, just straight up. And the only way to really climb it well was to kind of be along the side where there's some trees and roots and kind of, you know, make sure anytime you slip, you can grab a hold of that. And the thing that made it really hard was the descent on the other side. It was wet, and this granite, when it gets wet, it's just like ice. I mean, yeah, it is so slick, especially if there's a slight algae film or something. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Almost like mossy.
Yeah, yeah, except you can't really see it. The rock just looks a little bit dark.
Ugh.
And so you're kind of just going along, trying to kind of shuffle your feet so you don't lose control of yourself. And then you just like slip, and I fell on my butt multiple times on my back. Thankfully, my backpack cushioned that, and I didn't hit my head or anything. That would have been, yeah, I don't know what would have happened.
And if you would have started sliding or rolling,
yeah,
I mean, would you have gone several hundred feet before you would have?
It was never like a drop off, thankfully, during those points. So I probably would have rolled like into the side of the trail, okay, into a tree or, okay, something, maybe 15, 20 feet. Yeah, it was never like a, you know, like a luge slide or anything like that. So that was good, because that could have been really life-threatening. So yeah, slipped a few times. There was this other time on this mountain called Baldpate, where it was, yeah, no trees, no nothing. It was early in the morning, and I was climbing up there, and it was just blowing. Super foggy, like white-out fog. It's supposed to be great views. The only views I got were fog. And it was just bare rock, and you're trying to, like, climb along and trying to get your poles to grab a little chink in the rock, and I was cold too, like it was chilly that morning, so I was trying to keep moving so I wouldn't get hypothermia or anything, and I had all my layers on, which was hardly anything because I'd sent a bunch of stuff home because it was supposed to be warm, and I was so trying to get lightweight, so literally I had no insulating layers. I just had my rain jacket, which doubled as a wind jacket. So I had that in a shirt and pants. Anyway, yeah, no rain pants. So I tried to keep moving there, but just that was brutal, dude. I was a little bit afraid that I would get hypothermia. That was probably the worst time that I thought, man, I got to keep moving.
Mm-hmm. Were there times where you didn't see anyone on the trail for 4 or 5 hours?
Yeah, definitely. There was never a day where I didn't see anyone. But there were a few times during the weekdays New York, in northern part of Virginia. I mean, it was me and Weston, but we didn't see anyone for hours at a time. There were a couple places where you would hike along for hours and no one came by. It was crazy. It felt really like you're just out there into the wild.
Was it kind of eerie?
It was sometimes, but sometimes it was kind of nice too. Peaceful. It's like, man, you know what? I'm out here all alone. And this is just, I'm just hiking away, you know? I have everything I need on my back.
There you go.
It's crazy. Yeah.
Did you notice, like, on the weekends, was the trail a little bit more packed with people or no?
It depended on what area you were in, but especially if you were close to a park, like a national or state park, definitely. Like the Shenandoahs were packed. White Mountain National Forest, super, super busy.
When the trail was packed, did they slow you down? Not too much. Did you just kind of push them aside?
Yeah, no.
Just kind of push them off the trail.
I was very tempted to, but then I probably would have been liable, you know, to go get them, you know, and it's just
they would have probably sued.
I already
something.
Had enough weight on my back without having to carry someone up from a 150-foot gorge that I'd push them down. That would just.
I mean, you could have done it. It's just the time spent.
Yeah, I mean, really. I don't have 2 hours to go and haul up, you know, this dude and his wheelchair, you know, out of the gorge. Just would not have worked at all. So I tried to just bypass them, you know, kind of like Autobahn style. Just kind of swerve, cruise along. Yeah, so...
Is there general, like, hiking etiquette?
Etiquette, there is some, yeah. As a general rule, if somebody's going faster than you from behind, you need to get out of their way. Like, be paying attention. Mm-hmm. Also, if you're on a hill, the uphill hiker is supposed to have the right of way, just because it is hard to, like, get into a rhythm, you know, and once you're in your rhythm, especially if you're going uphill, it's good to stay there. Otherwise, you have to, like, stop, and then restarting almost takes, like, extra energy more than what just if you would have kept walking would have. But that's still the whole uphill hiker thing is a little bit like it's very flexible. If you see somebody is coming and they're going to keep on moving, get out of the way. Or if you see that you have a better spot to step off the trail and not like tear the place up, like a nice rock or something like that, you should step off even if you're going uphill. So, yeah, it's just be respectful. Common courtesy, you know, is the biggest thing.
Did you ever, like, make another hiker mad just because you weren't aware of them? Like, hey, dude, I'm hiking here.
No, but I got mad at other people because they weren't aware of me. I'm like, I'm walking behind them and I'm trying to,
like, bypass
cough
them
a few times. Click my poles together, and they're just kind of like doo doo doo.
You click your that like your like little
that's
hey.
Like a signal?
That's like you're flashing your headlights.
Yeah, exactly, honking.
So were a lot of the trails were pretty narrow then. At
often,
a lot of
yeah,
the way.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, it's not. It's very few times that there's more that it's more than a single file.
Okay.
Line.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. I had a question.
You had a couple questions.
Yeah, I've been having questions.
Yeah, shoot.
So, in retrospect, what do you feel was like the hardest hurdle that you had to maneuver?
Yeah,
like just in general, anything. Could be physical, could be mental, whatever.
Yeah, I think definitely the mental aspect, like, I'm thinking of, well, kind of the time that I said, that I mentioned earlier, where it was not quite halfway through, and I'm just thinking to myself, like, man, is it really worth it to go to all the way to the end? I mean, I can, there's lots of people that section hike it. I can section hike it. And just, like, constantly, the constant having to push myself,
mm-hmm.
like, okay, I got miles to do today. Get up and get her done. Mm-hmm. Just that, it became very wearying. There was one time, this wasn't so much a time of quitting, it was just a time where I could have gotten really discouraged, where I was in the 100-mile wilderness, and I got in a late start that morning because the hostel I had stayed at didn't get us out there till 8:30. And for those who don't know, the 100-mile wilderness, it's like 100 miles where you have virtually no access to town, and it's right before Baxter State Park, which is the end where Mount Katahdin is. So I was going in there the first day. I was going to try to do the whole thing, 100 miles, in like 3.5 days. And the first day I was just, it was hard. It was really hard. Like short, steep climbs, roller coaster all day. And I did not get the miles in that I wanted to. And I was just felt really, really discouraged. And because my parents were supposed to meet me on Saturday, and I had to get to the park by Saturday. And so I was going to hike in the dark for a while. So I hiked until like 9:30, close to 10. And I was just stumbling all over, couldn't find the trail. And I was like, you know what? This isn't worth it. I'm hardly getting anywhere for my efforts. So I blew up my air pad and laid down on this kind of bald, rocky area, I mean, smooth rock again, but on top of a mountain, and called my dad. And it was just really good. I was glad I had service then, because I called him, and we just talked about it, and he's like, hey, you know what? I told him, I'm feeling discouraged. And he just the remark he made just so stuck out to me. He's like, you know what? I'm not feeling discouraged. I'm feeling encouraged. You got this. And it was just that, just like, just telling me I got this. It's like, yeah, I got this, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know if that answers your question, but definitely the mental aspect was the hardest part, just fighting discouragement and mm-hmm. things like that. And there were some times also where the physical, but the physical thing is like, you know that it's going to end eventually. Mm-hmm. Like, you'll get to sleep that night, and you'll feel better tomorrow, but do you want to hike tomorrow, you know?
Yeah.
And that's the mental part of it.
Yeah.
I have a question. So was there ever a day where you just, like, decided to just kind of chill all day and not really do anything?
So as far as, like, taking 0 days, we took, I think, 3 of those on the trail. But I don't think any of them were ever because, I just can't. I'm done, and take mm-hmm. a 0 day there. It was more like it was time to take a 0 day. You know, physically you need to recover, and it was also so the one time was in so 3 times I took 0 days were when it was really nasty weather in the Smokies. It was like torrential rain and stuff like that, like literally inches of water flowing down the trails, like you're walking in a river. It's crazy.
Ugh.
So I took a 0 day, the one day in a shelter. The other time, second time, was in Virginia. Met up with a friend, Derek Yoder, cool, super cool guy. Met him at Bible school. Anyway, we stayed at his house. Then the third time was in Pennsylvania, where I took a day off to see my girlfriend.
Mm.
So, and that was definitely worth it. It was awesome.
What is the general rule for taking 0 days for recovery?
Yeah, it depends. It's just person, you know, each individual has their own standard. But basically, for me, it was if I was just, you become very in tune with your body when you're hiking like this. It's really weird. Like, you can tell if you're not eating enough calories, you mm-hmm. just feel drained. You can, yeah, everything. If you're not getting enough sleep, if you're dehydrated, you just sense it. So if I kind of felt like, man, my body is just, it's not, even with eating lots of food and sleeping, it's not able to recover, then I would do a like a Nero day, which is only like maybe 5 or 7 miles, or I could have taken a zero, but I never took a zero for that reason. I did take some Neros for that reason, though. Like, just hike a little bit to a hostel or hike a little bit out of a hostel to kind of extend the rest period.
Did you find that most days, like, you stopped hiking because you reached, like, the amount of miles that you had quoted for that day? Or was it just a thing of, well, it's dark now, so I might as well stop.
Hmm. Yeah.
Like, what was your limiter?
Yeah.
What did you decide would end your hike for that day?
So most of the time, I'd say probably 3/4 of the way, it was miles.
Okay.
Like, I need to make this many miles, or I need to be here in 4 days. So okay. I need to do, split it up evenly. And then towards the end, probably the last quarter, it was more, my body was in shape, I could do what I wanted. And it was more like, I'm going to push to get in as many miles as I can today. And then it was, hike until dark or after dark.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of your body.
Yes.
Did you like lose like a ton of weight?
Not as much as I thought. I was actually shocked that I didn't lose more weight. So I started out at about 167, which is weird because when I left camp, I was at like 180. But my weight when I left home in April was about 167. I weighed myself at a hostel like a couple weeks or a month or so in, and I was down to 164. When I came home for Leighton's wedding, I weighed myself, and I was up to 166. So that wasn't really a big deal. And then I weighed myself at a hostel in Maine, and that was right after the Whites. Right after the White Mountains, which is definitely the hardest extended section of the trail. Like, the White Mountains, they're big, they're rocky, they're steep, they're just really hard. And I was down to 155. Mm. So I lost, what it was at 12, 13 pounds, something. And then when I came home, I started to eat more. And then when I came home, I think I was up to 165 again. So
it wasn't that not really extreme of a change.
Yeah, which shocked me because like Weston said he lost a bunch of weight after he was hiking with me. Most people lose quite a bit of weight, especially if you have weight to lose,
it probably depends what kind of shape you're in too.
Yeah. Yeah, it probably does.
Not saying that Weston wasn't in good shape, but
yeah. But I mean, not as good as a chief,
Well, yeah,
you
of were, course.
You were out in the of wild course. For.
yeah, definitely. Running
also,
after bears.
So,
boys,
since you didn't lose that much weight, it wasn't that you didn't like have any drastic changes as far as like what size of clothes you had to wear.
No, I mean, I definitely noticed my waist had shrunk.
Okay.
So I'm not exactly sure how that worked. Maybe I lost some fat and gained some muscle or toned some muscle. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But my waist definitely shrunk some.
Okay.
But I'm gaining it back rapidly, man. Rapidly.
Good job.
It's not cool. I need to. Yeah, because like your appetite, I think it's going to take a very conscious effort to like tell my appetite, okay, no. You're not actually burning 5,000 calories.
You don't need as many calories as you did on the trail.
Exactly. Even though they're delicious.
But the appetite stays the same. Exactly. Like, your body thinks it does.
Exactly.
Okay.
Oh, that's crazy.
So what were some of the highlights? One or a handful of some of the highlights?
Yeah, so as far as people, really enjoyed hiking with my dad. That was so cool. Toward the end, I got to meet a guy named Graybeard, who's actually going to be the oldest hiker when he completes it. 82 years old. Crazy. Just looked fit as a fiddle. Mm. So that was pretty neat.
You had heard of him before,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, he's kind of like semi-famous.
Okay,
yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, it's pretty neat.
So you got to like meet
yeah,
one of your
took
heroes.
A selfie with him, and yeah, totally. Asked cool. some questions. He invited me. Yeah, so he's saving 1 mile to hike in Harper's Ferry, which is where the ATC headquarters is. And so I think end of September sometime, he's going to hike that mile with a bunch of other people. And they're going to kind of throw a completion party for him or
oh,
something.
Very oh, cool.
It's very cool. Yeah, definitely an accomplishment, especially for an 82-year-old. Amazing. there were a number of places that just so beautiful stuck out. One was right after the Smokies. It was this place called Max Patch, and it's just this giant bald. A bald is basically where there's like no trees on this mountain. Mm. So it wasn't that high in elevation, but it was just bald, grassy. We camped up there. Oh my word, 360-degree view all around. You have the surrounding mountain ranges and valleys. It was a beautiful day. It was just gorgeous. I mean, like, if you are in that area looking for a good spot to take your significant other or your family or something, it's not that hard of a hike. It's actually quite mild, and it's just it's gorgeous. And that it's in, so it would be in Tennessee, okay. I think. Yeah, southern, yeah. That was really cool. Another awesome spot was in Southern Virginia. It's a place called the Grayson Highlands, and that is basically, you're at pretty high elevation, but it's this semi-barren, rocky, just like wilderness area where all these wild ponies are. It's so bizarre. Like, instead of wild horses, which would be probably cooler, but you might not be able to get as close to them, you have these wild ponies. They're called wild ponies because, like, no one owns them, but they're semi-domesticated just because so many people pass through there. But they'll come up. They're kind of friendly. They'll nibble on your clothes a little bit.
Eat some of your trail mix.
Are they, I mean, are there colts? Are they reproducing? And
oh, yeah. Yeah, every spring they have a Roundup, pony Roundup, and I don't know what they do with them. But, yeah, a trail ranger was telling us about this. Yeah, they have this pony Roundup. They take the ponies off. I think they sell them at an auction, probably for ridiculous prices.
Well, they're
genuine
authentic,
wild pony.
Yeah. It is.
That's wow. Something.
Eight trail mix only once.
Exactly. Exactly.
I would not have expected that exists in America today.
Right? It's so neat. Yeah. Wow. Non-GMO. It's great. Good stuff. So that was really neat. And then I'd say my ultimate favorite was definitely the white. I mean, besides Katahdin. Was the White Mountains, White Mountain National Forest. Oh, just, they're like miniature Rockies. You just, like, long stretches of exposed ridgeline, or just dropping off to the side, like the canyons on either side of you, and it's just amazing. Yeah, wow, so cool. I mean, definitely the hardest part of the hike, the hardest extended section, but so worth it. Yeah,
so you would definitely say that the northern part, mm-hmm. the northern half of the Appalachian Trail is more difficult than the southern half. Or
that is a great question. It's all about perspective. It okay. really is, because in my mind the hardest mountains, I mean, okay, besides the whites, still in my mind though, the hardest mountains are the ones in Georgia.
Okay.
I mean, we're just killing ourselves on these climbs, you know, and I look back now, I was actually reading some of my earliest blogs, and I was just like, it's so funny. I was just like, that wasn't even that hard. What are you crying about?
Yeah, if only you knew what was to come.
Yeah, exactly. Good thing I didn't.
So if someone would be going for a half, they should do the bottom half first, just to, as far as that being easier?
Yes and no. I mean, you don't know any better, right? There were I met quite a few southbounders in the last month of my hike, where they had started, you know, in early June. They had done 100-mile wilderness, which is actually pretty easy except for the southern 30, 40 miles of it, and then straight into the whites. They're doing, like, the hardest, you know, if maybe 70% of the work. You know, if you can put a percentage on it, they're doing 70 or 80% of the work, and the rest is easy, you know. So, but they don't know any better. They take it slow, which is maybe a better way to do it, instead of trying to blast through their 25 and 30 mile days. So yeah, I wouldn't say you need to start in the south. You just do what your body can handle.
Mm-hmm.
And then you started this website, Mountain Manuscripts, mm-hmm. to kind of document your journey through the Appalachian Trail.
Yeah.
Are you going to continue updating it?
Yeah, I haven't decided yet. I'm done for a little while. But yeah, I'm going to think about it. It was kind of fun doing blogs, but I'm not sure what I'd write about. Yeah, so I'll think about it, but no guarantees.
All right. So, but you're planning on keeping it at least online,
yeah,
even if
yeah,
you
wouldn't
update
it. Yeah, I'll keep it online.
Yeah. Okay. So, and that is mountainmanuscripts.com.
Yes, that is correct.
All right. And so, what does the future hold for you? You went on this.
What does the future hold for Highlander?
2,000-plus mile journey.
Yeah. Well, don't know completely, but I have a few ideas. so many ideas. But anyway, the immediate future entails going to Faith Builders. I'm enrolled in their teacher apprenticeship program. So that's a 2-year program, and I'll be starting that April 9th. Well, I need to be out there April 19th. I'll get settled in, and then classes start.
You mean August?
Or August. Did I say April?
Yeah.
August. August 19th, and then it just runs, regular school year. So.
Okay. Exciting. So you do, either way, though, you do think some kind of teaching is in your future.
Yeah, education. I think I love working with youth. I love working with kids, especially older kids. I feel like that was a point of time in my life that was very influential. And my time at camp, I think, kind of confirmed that for me. I had the older group, 14 to 16. And so it's like, you know what? I really feel like that is where I'm called at this point. So, yeah, I'd like to be a high school teacher. Don't totally know if that'll all work out yet. But, moving forward at least with getting some education and training for that.
Cool. Jeff, do you have any questions for Highlander?
Would you prefer people
not
still call
anymore.
You Highlander?
No. Either, just Courtney, something like that. Or Chief, if you so desire, or if you've called me that.
If you would ever wake up, feeling kind of, drowsy, and, it's hard to get out of bed, and your voice is just, it doesn't sound, it's kind of sleepy, but...
Mm-hmm.
You sound a little bit whatever,
mm-hmm.
Sickly. Would it be safe to call you Highlander Grog?
I did not see that one coming at all.
I didn't either.
Where is this going? That could be
it,
a safe moniker.
All right, cool. For those of you who don't know, Highlander Grog is... a flavor of coffee bean, a flavor of roast at Main Street Coffee House in Napanee. So I just had to throw that in there. And it is my favorite.
Mm-hmm. It's my favorite
out of,
flavored coffee.
Out of yes. The flavored roasts.
Courtney, is there anything that you wanted to say before we kind of move on from the Appalachian Trail and start talking about Jeff and Layton?
Our other the much more boring stuff.
Yeah, I don't know if I have anything profound, but I would encourage those of you who are listening to this that dream big. Part of one of the reasons that I'd mentioned was that this was a dream I had, and I wanted to pursue it, and I think that is something that that we can do more of. That we have a dream or we have a goal or something in mind, and I think God gives us those. I really do.
Mm-hmm.
And if he gives it to us, he'll be with us through it, all the way through. He'll make sure that we can accomplish it. So don't live out of fear, go do those things, and don't be scared of failing. So yeah.
All right, thank you, Courtney, for coming onto the podcast. And definitely, people, go check out his website. And definitely, there were a lot of times when you were discouraged through that, but you stuck it out. And I can definitely see when you mentioned that the hardest things were kind of the mental aspect of it. Not to say that the physical part would be easy, but I can totally see where the thought of, it's not like there's someone holding a gun to your head. You could just stop. And you didn't. So, good job on that. And... yeah, that's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Jeffy, you're here, and now you're in front of the microphone.
Yes.
Layton, last week you talked about how your house was destroyed.
It was. In more ways than one.
Did you want to tell us exactly what happened?
Yeah. So my sister just got married. Amazingly, a month after I got married, it's been quite a month of marriages. And so since my sister got married, obviously what follows after a marriage is a honeymoon. And since my sister has a dog, she needed someone to take care of the dog whilst they were off in Spain. And my sister knew that my wife would like a dog in the house. And
before you continue, I would just like to make the point that I and Layton's other friends warned him not to let this happen. Not to let the dog's foot inside the door, as
it's
it were.
It's inside the door.
Metaphorical paw and literal paw.
Right.
But what happened?
Metaphorical foot.
So this, I'm not too keen on having an animal in the house. I tried to persuade my wife, like, hey, what if we would just do, like, a very small animal that would be, like, kept, like, in a cage. Like, a fish has a fishbowl. A hamster has a little glass pen. What do you call this? A cage. A bird has a cage. Mm-hmm. You know, and I thought, like, any one of these would be fine. But she said that she felt bad for the animal. And so if we any animal that we do have has to be able to free roam in the house.
She wants to live on a farm is what she wants. With roosters.
Well, I mean, it's not that she wants to live on a farm, but it's that the house must be a farm. Ah.
What's the like size limit? Like, would she be okay with like a cow? Like a potbelly pig?
A pig was
that was disgusting.
Yeah. And for it's still guys. Kind of on the tape.
For you guys.
Yes.
I have heard that pigs are fairly clean house pets,
yeah.
Surprisingly.
Yeah.
One reason that myself and some of our friends were advising Layton to not let this happen...
Mainly you.
...was for our own future benefit.
For your future benefit.
In case at some point in time, us or my friends would get married, this would just be ammunition for our wives to
your
say,
wife.
Look at Layton. Carrie has a pig and a dog in their house. Why can't we have just a small little poodle?
It's like setting a precedent.
Yeah.
If the precedent is set, what's the limit?
Exactly. Yeah, I know. Exactly.
First, it starts with a small goldfish. And it ends with a pig running around, leaving hoof marks on the linoleum floor.
I feel like a poorly trained dog is worse than a pig.
But I agree with you.
I feel like a dog in the house is the worst kind of animal to have in the house.
The worst kind.
Yeah.
As far as the general scent of the house, but cats just have so much hair.
Cats, they do. I would put cats just one level less worse.
Yeah.
Than a dog. But definitely, I would, of goldfish, that'd be great.
Yeah.
She could talk to it.
Yeah. You can have a whole family of those.
I see her point. You can't cuddle with a goldfish. You just can't. And so I understand, like, why that just isn't a thing. And I'm not saying that my wife is a bad person for wanting a pet. Like, she...
I'm saying you're a bad person for letting this happen.
It's just she's much more of an animal lover than what I am. But anyways, so we start off on this week-long experiment of having a dog, having my sister's half Yorkie, half poodle, a York poodle, a porky? I don't know what to call it, but this small dog in the house. And my wife's excited about it. I'm like... kind of like, okay, this will all be over in a week. What could possibly happen? So, some things happened. The first day, it's in the house. What could it possibly get to? We put everything away. There were no wires that I could get tangled in or like chew up. We have a separate little breezeway to put our shoes so it couldn't chew up the shoes. All the food was put away. It's fine. Except for the dog food, of course. I get home and the dog.
Do you want us to guess?
Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
You said you put all the food away, everything's away, but I'm guessing it was something to do with the trash. It probably pushed over the trash and was eating through your garbage.
Okay, that's your guess. Jeff, do you have a guess as to what the dog was doing or got into?
Well,
was it there? Hold on, was it there all day?
Yes.
By itself?
Since like from 7 o'clock until about 4 o'clock.
Okay, I'm changing my vote.
To me, the most defiling thing would be if it would like jump on my bed and totally wreck everything they're in.
Wrecking your bed, that's the worst.
Well, and just like leaving hair and maybe peeing a little bit.
Just a little. Just not a little. Much.
Just enough that you know
you
it's
know
there
there's
somewhere.
A scent, but you can't spot the spot.
Exactly.
That's the worst.
Did you have a guess, Courtney?
No, I can't imagine.
I'm changing mine. It had something to do with a bodily function. If it was that long.
Okay.
And I hope that's what it was anyway, because I feel like that's the best thing that could happen for you to agree that you should not have a dog.
Okay.
So, yeah.
This dog is actually very well trained. I think it pooped once, but it was in our shoe breezeway. So it was not in the house, number one. Other than that, the rest of the times, we let it out, and it pooped and peed outside. And that's good. That's good. Good on it. That actually won my respect a little bit. Like, oh, okay, so these things are kind of manageable. They do have, like, some sort of decency. But I get home from the first day after it's been at the house by itself for the first day, and it's barking at me through the window. It's not the worst sign, but the problem is that the window is not just a window. It was peeking through the blinds, and so it's whatever. I see the dog, like, oh, it's so happy to see me. Okay, this is cool. I unlock the door, whatever, come inside. And then the dog, like, turns around. And it was up on the back of the couch. And looking at me through the window. So now that I've come inside, it wants to naturally jump down to the floor and greet me with yipping and stuff. Because it's so happy to see me. But it can't. Because its hind legs are tangled up in the blinds. And the blinds are like, and it can't jump down. It's
did you get a video or picture of this?
I didn't. I got a picture of my blinds. The post the results, how the blinds looked afterwards. And it did. We have some faux wood blinds, and it's held up by a string ladder. Whoever has faux wood or wooden blinds of anything with like a lot of, with like a good amount of thickness, with the slats are a thick, you'll know what I'm talking
like
about.
Like dig deep depth, at a deep depth. You're saying like, yes. Like the slats are large,
like 2 inch wide.
So there's like a good amount of space in between them.
Correct.
Can I see the photo?
Yeah. Anyway, so it wrecked the one string ladder that holds up the middle of the blinds. And
this
my wife,
severe destruction.
When she got home, she felt so bad.
For who? For the dog or for you or for herself?
She felt bad that the dog got into the blinds. And she felt like it was kind of her fault.
Okay.
Mainly because she was the pet enthusiast. I assured her it's fine. She was afraid that we'd have to buy new blinds. But thankfully, there is a website called fixmyblinds.com. Who? I don't know how they came up with that URL, but it is brilliant. And you can buy replacement parts for your blinds at a very cheap price. So it was like an $8 fix.
Did you have to like restring it? Like manually like re-thread each thing?
Yes, I do. I do have to do that. Yeah. So it'll take a little bit of work, but it's fine. It's totally fine. Okay, so we skipped to the next day.
So this is all day number one.
That was day number one. Day number two, and this is the only other day that I'm going to mention. And this isn't necessarily the dog's fault, but I teased that my house was destroyed. This was the next way that my house was destroyed. That was on Monday. Tuesday is a busy day. No, I'm sorry. Was it Tuesday? Did we podcast last Tuesday?
We did podcast, but we did it later.
It was late. That's right. Okay, that's how I know that I was able to squeeze all this in. So, Tuesday, sadly, one of my coworker's brothers passed away. And so, the viewing and funeral were both on a Tuesday. And we had to go right after work. Me and one of my coworkers were going to drive down to the viewing. Okay, so my coworker drops me off at home, and then I quickly shower, but alas, my bowels need to be relieved. And so I do my business, and it was a good amount. It was enough that it overwhelmed the toilet.
Trail mix amount.
It was.
Toilet overwhelming, Batman.
Yes. And so I try to flush. I can't. It doesn't work. It's not happening.
I can't believe you're sharing this on the podcast. I'm just surprised.
Well, it's just, and then I try to, my wife thought it would be better for the dog to be in the breezeway as opposed to the rest of the house so it doesn't get in the blinds again. Yes. So, and rightfully so, and then I'm like, okay, the dog probably needs to be relieved. So I'm going to quickly, like, I've been relieved, but it doesn't go away. The dog probably needs to be relieved because I just got home from work. So I let the dog into the house. And just as I'm about ready to let him out of the house, my coworker drives up and says, hey, we got to go to the viewing. Come on. And so I'm like, I'm sorry, Vern, you can't go outside. You cannot relieve yourself like I did. But why don't you go ahead and bask in my stench as it lofts through the house? So I leave.
And you leave him in the house.
And I leave him in the house just because we got to go. So I leave. In the meantime, my wife comes home. And it's quite a, she's pretty sure, I mean, by this smell, I mean, surely it was the dog. Surely this was the dog stinking up the place. I don't know how much false blame it got. But to her surprise, when she let him out, he went. And it's like, how did you have more stored up? No. We go to the viewing. We come back. My wife is a little bit perplexed, but she noticed that the toilet isn't working. And I assure her, it was me. And so then I had to make a special trip over to Dollar General just to get a plunger. And when a plunger is the only thing that you are buying, everyone knows why you're buying it and that there is something foul sitting somewhere that should be away.
That should be gone.
It should be not there. But alas, it's what I had to do. Mm. There were some Amish people in front of me in the Dollar General line that looked at me a little bit like, you terrible person. And I...
Do Hetchnet set us so long, Halda?
Yeah. Exactly. I'm sure that's what they were thinking, Jeff. But then What's crazy is, though, I get home with the plunger, and I do, like, one, like, I don't know what the scientific way of plunging the dark matter.
I'm pretty sure there's not science. It's more magic.
Well, I'm just not sure what method is the correct method, the proper method. But I always do a flush, and then when it, like, shows that it's struggling, when it tries to do the swirl and then it doesn't, then I go into full plunge mode. I don't know if that's the proper way.
And do you use quick, a quick motion, like you're stop, like killing a mouse or a bug or something?
I do like a quick jabbing motion.
Okay.
Like that's repetitive. Very quick and repetitive. And it makes so that there's like a central ripple that goes back and forth and back and forth until like all of a sudden like there's like droplets almost reaching up and like touching your hand. But it makes you feel like you're living on the edge. It gives me such a rush. as does the toilet. anyway, but so I was doing like my beginning like flush to watch it start struggling. But the struggle never came. It finally had softened up enough that it was able to just naturally go down.
Right,
so I never actually had to use it.
Wow.
I have a brand new plunger, never been used.
Well, from Dollar General. I feel like it's
I went through all the humiliation of buying just a plunger. I made the plunger trip. The plunger trip of shame.
The plunger trip of shame.
No reason.
I feel like it's better. I feel like it's better to have an unused plunger in the corner of your bathroom than a used one.
I don't know.
Because used ones just are nasty.
Yeah, used ones are nasty, but it's good if your guest has like a, you know, if I would have someone come over and they dropped something similar to what I did, if they could at least see like one single reassuring skid mark on the side of the plunger, then they can like rest assured like, oh, this has been used before.
This has been
like,
used. This
it's
is
seen,
your problem.
It's seen this before. I like, know, I'm not
but most people
defiling the plunger. It's already been.
Did you leave? When I walk into a bathroom, I like to see a sticker on the plunger because then I know it's never been used.
Yeah.
Do you have a sticker on your plunger?
I don't remember peeling anything off of it.
Okay, well, it's probably there. Just turn it so that people can see it when they walk in.
I want to like just have the skid mark showing.
This reminds me of the time I went to visit my cousins, and I hadn't seen them. They lived out in Montana at the time, and I literally had not seen them for probably 3 or 4 years. It was like way too long. And so I was like super excited about getting there. We drove the whole way out. So long, long drive. Anyways, and I got there with my grandparents. I rode with my grandparents. It's just us. And the first thing I have to do when I get there is just unload. And I promptly...
Your bags?
Yes. I promptly plugged that toilet harder than it's ever been plugged before. It was just like great first impression. My cousins were impressed.
We broke the ice. Hard.
Did they have a plunger there?
They did. I think it was in another room, and it had to be...
So you had to ask for it?
Yeah.
That's the worst. When you have to ask for the plunger, make every plunger, like...
Available.
Easy to see.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you ever see those, like, the sink plungers? Those are actually, like, almost cute. Like they're
sink
like
plunger.
They're like maybe a quarter or an eighth of the size of a normal plunger. They're just like
and very flat.
They're like 6 inches round.
They don't have
like
much of a depth.
Yeah, they just look like a normal plunger, kind of, and they're just got maybe a
but they're for the
15
sink.
Inch channel. It was for a sink.
Yeah.
What would you be flushing? Oh, that kind of a sink. I was picturing like a bathroom sink.
Yeah, no, it's just like a
you
bathroom.
Could
probably
sink. Also use
like,
it for
or
a shower
tub
drain.
Or a shower drain or whatever. They make them. I don't know how much they actually get used, but I mean,
do you think they'd work in a toilet?
I think they would go down the toilet because they're so small.
Wouldn't that work though?
Maybe. it might clear the blockage, but it would create another problem.
Yeah, then you'd have serious problems,
like
excessive blockage.
Oh,
something
the
that
plunger
won't,
got stuck in the toilet.
That won't
get another plunger.
Something that won't soften just by letting it sit.
Yeah, you pour some acid down there.
All right. Jeff, you had told me you have a news story.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah, so I actually just read about this before we started the podcast, and I was blown away. A good example of accepting professional work for what it is, and if you have a professional do something for you, and they do a good job, you should accept their price. And even if it may be steep, some work is worth that, you know, for like painting or car detailing or whatever it is. So anyways, this photographer in, I can't find an article right now where they were from. Anyways, this photographer went and photographed somebody's wedding.
Was it somewhere in the United States?
It was somewhere in the U.S. Okay. Yes, yes. Okay, Dallas County. It just says Dallas County. So I'm assuming Texas. Anyways, and so this photographer went and shot a wedding. And usually wedding photographers are really good. They're experienced. They do a lot of editing.
They're supposed to be.
They're supposed to be good, yeah. And this was a pretty decent one.
Especially it depends what price range they're in.
Right, right. This was a little bit in the higher price range.
Okay.
Anyways, and so she went and shot the wedding. And then when designing the album, she, of course, designed a nice album artwork, you know, for the front cover. And then when she turned in her bill to the couple, they were, like, freaked out that the album cover cost them $150. And that's how much she was asking for it. Which is, granted, a steep price, but I'm assuming it was pretty professionally done.
It costs what kind of material $200+ just to get a logo designed.
Yeah,
From 99.
So I mean, it's not like an insane amount to ask for. I mean, it's a lot.
No. I think he was using.
I was saying that's like $150 for the cover is pretty cheap.
Oh, yeah. Okay. That's what
I was thinking.
Well, maybe in regards of book covers. Either way, so this couple was just not willing to pay this price, and they made a big stink about it on social media.
Not as big of a stink as I made.
No, it was actually pretty big.
Okay.
Because
this didn't go away over time. This got worse over time.
Rather than just like trying to work out a deal or just saying, hey, let's do something different that doesn't cost as much, they went straight to social media.
Oh, no.
And saying that the photographer was absolutely ripping them off, and they were just bashing, just constant, like a barrage of bashing online publicly.
Barrage of bashing.
Tagging the photographer's page, all that kind of stuff, whatever that was involved, it was pretty significant and significantly reduced the photographer's customer base.
Uh-oh.
Like a lot. Within a year, the business pretty much almost tanked simply because of this bashing that went on. I don't know how influential the couple was that got married, but obviously did a lot of damage. And she, the photographer, because of this, realizing she was losing business, not wanting to have issues with customers, offered to just do it for free. And the couple totally refused and still kept on going off on social media about it. Well, end of story. They went to court. Photographer filed a defamation lawsuit,
desecration lawsuit.
Because of the amount of business that she lost for it, and then the couple immediately went on the defensive, claimed that somebody else was using their social media, all this kind of stuff, in court, you know, perjury, all that kind of stuff. So they finally figured out that it was actually them using the account, them posting all the stuff, and they proved this, and the settlement, and Grant, remind you, the photographer offered to do this for free at one point,
mm-hmm.
Before she filed the lawsuit,
mm-hmm.
But the court ruling was in favor of the photographer, and the damages, including punitive damages, was $1.08 million.
Now, you said that the album cover artwork or designing that was $150.
Yeah.
Do you know how much the whole package was?
I don't.
That's obviously just a small part.
I don't, actually.
And did the couple, were they willing, and did they pay for the other services?
They did, for the photos themselves? From this article, it seems that they did. It seems like...
They paid everything except this $150.
Well, it seems like the album cover fee was the big kicker. You know, maybe they were strapped for cash or something. I don't know, and they just didn't want to pay it, and they were like... Oh my word, this is insane.
I don't understand. I don't sympathize with them at all. The only way that they should even be remotely like a little bit annoyed or just like not satisfied with the photographer is if his price was way higher than what he had quoted. That's the only way.
Yeah, I'm on the photographer's website now, and I don't see like
A price
or anything like that.
Okay,
but she is nationally acclaimed, so definitely a top of the level.
And now she just made the French press news. So
now she has made
the French press.
My goodness, she's her like. Not only is she like, has she been paid $1.8 million, but now she's like getting really famous for having won that case.
Exactly.
So she's probably going to get even more customers now.
Yeah.
Is it a woman?
Yeah, it is a woman. Yes. Okay. Yes.
All right. That's all I've got. Leighton, anything more from you?
No.
Jeffy?
I think that's it for today.
All right. Thank you guys for listening. And I know we've said this before, but if you know of someone who you'd like to hear on the podcast, maybe they have an interesting story or something to share, let us know. Send us an email, mail at frenchpresspodcast.com, and we'd be happy to look into it, having them on the podcast.
And don't forget to click that Amazon link.
That's right. Leighton, what is our word of the week?
Word of the week is Highlander.